You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Andrea, for those that haven't come across you online, introduce yourself and let our listeners know what we're talking about today.
By my accent, I think most people can guess without even seeing me. And by my name as well, Andrea, that I'm not from the US. I'm Italian. I grew up in Italy and I've spent also 10 years in Brazil where I started my professional career. I've been working with some tech companies such as Groupon and Tinder. I was the head of Tinder, the dating app in Brazil for 5 years. I also had experience after that at L'Oreal. I was the chief digital officer at L'Oreal, totally different business. That's when I also started interacting more with pharmacies and the health sector. From then, 2019, I left the company and I started doing fully keynote speaking. And interestingly enough, one of the biggest customers is definitely pharma companies. They invest a lot in keynote speakers such as me that speak about digital transformation, which is my main topic nowadays. I have 3 books published in Portuguese, but I also have my latest launch in English, my first book in English. It's called Meta Leadership, the new skill set for leaders in the world of AI and Web3. And today, Mike, I'm sure we're going to cover some of the key topics in the book, and we're going to definitely tie them to the reality of our listeners to make things applicable to our day-to-day jobs whenever we manage our pharmacies or our businesses.
All right. First of all, let's get some things out of the way here. Tinder. The closest I'm ever going to be associated with Tinder is right now talking to somebody that works there. They don't have an old fart section, right?
No, they don't. And as well as definitely if you were already in a relationship, I'm sure, Mike, that you haven't had the chance for that.
I should have started with I'm married. So that's the main reason. But then I'm looking at being an old fart. So you're the closest I'm going to get. Now, Andrea, the listeners know I pick on this, but every year, pharmacies that deal with certain wholesalers, they're forced to go to these 3-day conventions, and they force you to go because they give you discounts off of your purchases for the rest of the year. And I'm not up there doing it myself, but they have got some horrendous speakers from these wholesalers. So these are the people that they might be the VP of retail sales or something like this. And I don't blame the people so much. I blame the company that says, we're going to get you up on stage and you're going to pretend like you're Steve Jobs and you're going to go up there. And it's just awful. And again, I'm not saying I would do any better, but it seems like these corporations need to either give more training or just admit that these people aren't always the best and bring in someone like you or hire someone like you full time who's like the communications guy or something, because it's really bad. And so I had to get that off my chest when we start talking about keynote stuff.
Oh, Mike, that's so much true. The truth is that the first thing that I've learned from the keynote speaking market and as a keynote speaker myself is that having knowledge does not mean you're going to be a good speaker. And oftentimes companies that put on their VPs and C-levels on stage think that. And that's a very big mistake because it's true, these C-levels do have a lot of experience and knowledge, but this does not translate necessarily in a good keynote speech. And so because of the fact companies think that, they don't train them. And therefore, they put them on stage and expect good results and people in the audience get extremely bored and just sit on with their phone open the whole time. And that's definitely not the idea of any keynote speaker. And interestingly enough, to be honest, I do some of the exact job that you described myself, being kind of like not a spokesperson, but kind of like an internal communicator, meaning I participate to a number of these meetings and try to send messages that companies feel none of their C-levels would be able to. And I've done that for a number of companies, especially outside of the health sector, but I do that, for example, NVIDIA, the AI giant. I'm their official podcast host in Brazil. And I do this kind of like translating AI into something that is understandable, which is something that most of the C-levels within the company itself cannot do. And so you're perfectly spot on, Mike, when you say that these conferences are extremely boring, just exactly because of the fact that we tend to associate a good keynote speech with just a lot of dense information. And that's exactly not the purpose. You have to inspire people, make them think. And wow, Mike, and you run a podcast and you know how it is because it's the exact same logic, right? People will never pay attention if you're not engaging across one full hour, right? And so imagine being on stage and you're stuck there. You cannot even just go for a run as you do with podcasts, right?
I'm sure, Andrea, it's across the board. I see it mainly in pharmacy. But then here's the problem, I think, is they try to get these people up there and they want to put the hoodie on them like Zuckerberg, and they want them to wear the tennis shoes and relate to the crowd. But then the problem is, besides that looking manufactured, the problem is with cancel culture now, you've got to be careful if you're up on stage and if they let you go off the script at all, you might say something derogatory to a certain group without even knowing it, or say a word that is not PC enough these days, refer to someone in an older term, this and that. And so I think that it's challenging to mix all those together.
It is very challenging, Mike. And the truth is that whenever we look at that, it is not only sensitive topics to wider audiences. It might be even be within that specific company, mentioning a competitor or mentioning something very specific, up to the point that any keynote speaker that is well-trained and goes through a professional process, usually you have very in-depth briefings wherever you go through the do's and don'ts, and they might tell you, don't touch upon this topic because it's very sensitive. And again, these C-levels are so busy that they don't even put too much thinking in it. And so I think that's a really important topic. At the same point, nobody is born a keynote speaker. When we look at evolution, human beings evolved in tribes of like up to 100 people. So we're not inborn with the ability to speak in front of hundreds or thousands of people. We can develop this skill. And so it really is a skill as well. And I think more and more important, because of the fact that C-levels and executives have to engage with a different kind of audience, which is Gen Zers and these new kind of people, that they expect a new type of communication as well. Shorter, more concise, more digital, and we're already touching upon digitalization, but a C-level nowadays can even be good, let's say, at giving a 40-minute speech on stage. But if also he or she is not good at doing a one-minute TikTok, they might not be appealing to, or in the company they represent might not be appealing to Gen Zers that are recently graduating and that represent the talent pool out there. So there's many facets to it. And I think it all revolves around these new types of communication.
The keynote now is basically just the main course. Unlike in the old days where you just showed up for that, you've got, or your team, you've got to plant the seed a little bit a couple weeks before. They need a picture of you talking to so-and-so. And then an hour before you go on stage, there has to be a TikTok of you doing this or that. And then you have to follow up with some shout-outs on Twitter and things like that. And so it's not a one-and-done kind of thing. Every keynote's like a whole story wrapped around you.
Yeah, to the point that Gary Vee, the famous, like, sort of, we can call him, like, social media entrepreneur, he says, like, put out, like, I don't know, like around 50 pieces of content a day, or at least that's what he does. And I'm not saying that we're all able to do that. He has a big team behind him. But the point here is we have to construct like a communication journey. Let's think about a podcast episode as well, Mike. Like, podcast has, there's like some interval in between one episode and the other. And there's many ways we can engage our audience in between and make them be eager for the new episode and be in expectation, maybe get some bits of it. And so I think that's extremely important. And you as a podcast host, you definitely know how to do that. But definitely there's also a lot of podcasts out there. They just sit down and for like 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours now. And even to the point that long format is now reducing. You don't see so many of those like 3 hours long podcasts being viral anymore. Joe Rogan and the big ones are shortening their interviews because people are not paying attention to the end anymore.
You know what, Andrea? I didn't even think about that because when I set my show length, I always think of it as like you and I are in a car together and we're just driving to the beach or something, an hour away, just chit-chatting. And it seems like after an hour would be a time that you'd stop or you'd get there. Just an hour seems about right. For some people, it's 20 minutes and some people, it's 5 minutes. But with Rogan, what gave me permission to do an hour was his 3 or 4 hours. And then you'd see Tim Ferriss, and you'd see, who's my guy? Who's the Russian?
Lex Friedman.
Yeah, Lex, you know, and they're going a long time, but I haven't delved into their stuff recently. I'll listen to it like on my walk in the morning, and that's 45 minutes or so. And so I'm never caring how long theirs is, but I didn't know that they're starting to shorten those.
Yes, and you know what, Mike? You made me think, I think that at the beginning they were recording for that long because based on, let's say, a 3 hours conversation, you could extract maybe, you had more chances, and you still have, to extract, let's say, a 1 minute viral conversation. And that's the strength of like YouTube shorts and things like these. Up to the point that, maybe there's also the good side of it. Let's say you increase the chances of extracting something very meaningful. So I don't know, Mike, you make me rethink on that side, but definitely, yeah. The full conversation is hard to follow.
So if you look at like Rogan's timing, can you tell that some of them are getting shorter now?
Yeah. And I've seen also articles also describing that the average length. Yes, that's one side of it. There's another side of it, which is not really related to their episodes themselves, which is related to the number of new podcasts being launched. And that has reduced dramatically. Right. During the pandemics, everybody rushed to launch their own podcast. I launched mine, of course, in Portuguese because Brazil is still my biggest market. But I launched it during the pandemics because I had a lot of time available. After the pandemics, two things happened. First of all, producers had less time available, or at least they had to get back traveling and stuff. But at the same time, listeners started having less time available, or at least reduced the time that you could listen to something without interruption. And so I think there's a direct correlation there. And it might be interesting to see through Spotify and all the platforms, they share some interesting analytics. I would be intrigued to see. You can check yours, Mike. I will check mine. And we can definitely see whether people are paying, I wouldn't say less attention, but their time span, like their attention time span has been reduced. I would guess yes, but I'm not sure. I will check into the numbers. That's definitely an interesting conversation for other producers out there. But even if people have a chance to share with us here through social media after they listen to this, I would be eager to know what's their consuming pattern.
Well, TikTok now, let's say the average TikTok is, I don't know, 30 seconds or something like that. The old days, they had the credits run for 5 minutes on the show, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang or something. They'd list everybody and finally the movie would start 5 minutes in. And then with advertising and stuff, well, you got to catch someone's attention in the first 10 seconds. Now it's like, if you don't catch their attention in 0.3 seconds instead of 0.5 seconds, you've lost them. Now, I might be exaggerating a little bit, but boy, that time span is like down to nothing now.
Yeah. And you know what's also interesting, Mike, that I had this kind of like preset belief that on TikTok, it would be very hard to share, for example, business content, right? So I would, you know, associating it with the, you know, quick dances and kind of like funny videos. And I don't know about you, Mike, but I've started diving deeper into TikTok. And what's interesting is that there is like very interesting content. And that idea that you cannot really share deep or meaningful content into very short time frames, at least to me, I've lost that preconceived notion. So there's a lot of like traveling tips or like whenever I want to look for a new restaurant in a new city that I'm visiting, because TikTok, interestingly enough, is very easy to search within TikTok. And so I've started producing some like shorter bits when it comes, not really like to digital transformation, but maybe to leadership, future of work, also keynote speaking tips. And the engagement is much higher than Instagram and any other platform. I also use LinkedIn a lot. But that's also because TikTok wants to share your content with a lot of people so that you feel that dopamine rush. But it's an interesting platform, and especially when it comes also to the privacy issues, it's a very delicate one to share very like deep and sensitive content, or at least to rely too much upon it. But I've seen more and more very good business content on there.
Better Cottage, I bought a TV, and I was looking for a way to put the wall mount on the back, and I had to go into some brick and so on.
Right.
I could have gone to YouTube, but the problem with YouTube is you're going to get a 20-minute show. And I do like how YouTube now, you can see where the other viewers, there's that graph, and see where other viewers have come in. But the thing about TikTok, you can put in there TV mount, and you get hundreds of videos, and you know they're going to be 30 seconds, so you know they're going to be sharp and to the point. And then TikTok has some algorithm where they're not showing you repeats, where YouTube, you might come across the same video. And you put anything in there. I looked up beavers the week before because I thought I saw a beaver out in the yard. It's amazing the depth of TikTok. It's really deep.
It definitely is. And to be honest, even for pharmacy owners, like, there's so many things you can do. Some of the things that I've seen, and Brazil is a country that uses a lot of social media, and TikTok is very big here, but I've seen that in the US as well. So what I notice is that, for example, product reviews are very easily done on TikTok. Let's say a new launch of a brand that you work with, and a brand that is doing a launch, and they're giving you this incentive, either commercial or not, to talk about that product, right? Either you're an end consumer, but let's talk about pharmacy owners now. If you do very interesting or maybe out of the box reviews on TikTok, you will drive so much business to your pharmacy.
Talking about generational stuff, Andrea, it's like, if right now you're thinking of Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, you're almost a little bit too late on that stuff. I mean, you think it's like, how can I be too late? I just heard of it. It's like, well, try telling your eighth grader that your mom is using Facebook. Guess what they don't want to use anymore? And then tell them that your freshman in college is using Instagram. The eighth grader doesn't want to do that. It's like every 3 years, they want their own new world. And TikTok's going to be gone pretty soon. And this stuff reinvents itself every 3 years or so, or 2 years.
That's totally correct. And the interesting thing is that this not only happens in social media, but it happens across the board. Even let's think about the business of pharmacies. Whether it hasn't changed, and I'm sure our audience might agree, whether it hasn't changed more over the last 5 years than in the previous 20 years. And I'm sure it will change more over the next 2-3 years than it has ever changed. And this gets back to the law itself of computing, because it's all related to the Moore's law that says capacity of semiconductors doubles every 2 years. It's an exponential law. And so it brought about the element of exponentiality in businesses, which was something that no other innovation or no other technological breakthrough had ever brought about, right? Mechanical innovations would change businesses only linearly. And whenever something changes linearly, well, it's easier to adapt. We had to reinvent ourselves like maybe a couple of times across whole careers or decades,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
Now, 6 months ago, ChatGPT launched and our whole notion of content creation has changed. And so whenever we look at that, I think this exponentiality, as you said, things are going to change faster and faster. And as the futurologist Gert Leonhardt uses to say, the problem is that humans evolve linearly. And so there's a conflict there. There's a conflict in that, how can we adapt so quickly? And so I think that's the big challenge for any business owner nowadays, is how do I keep myself updated, not only in social media, but in anything that happens there. Social selling now is a big thing, right? And how we can engage with influencers to resell our products, as much as back in the days we had, as Ray Kroc, the founder and first CEO of McDonald's, would knock on doors of people trying to sell them like milkshake machines. Well, now people do that on social media and again. And so what's the opportunity there for us? I think that's a very important question. Maybe an even better question is our pharmacy changing at the rate that the patient's changing out there, that our customer, that our distributor, that our competitor is changing? Because if we do not change at the same rate, means that inevitably there will be a bigger gap that someone else will come in and get. And it does not mean it's someone in our region, someone in our area. Could be like Amazon tried to launch a pharmacy, not so successfully, but could be anyone else in the future. Platforms, e-commerce, social selling, any influencer. And so there's a lot of changes there happening, Mike. I think we have to always think about it.
AI seemed to take people by surprise. We always thought that the world was going to change from blue collar up. People talked about robots in the pharmacy and burger flippers at McDonald's and things like that. But it seemed to take people by surprise, and maybe part of it was the realization that it was changing the world from the top down, from lawyers and PhDs, and I think everybody froze in their tracks and didn't know what to do.
Wow, that's perfect, Mac. I think nobody saw that coming, and interestingly enough, I think even Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, mentioned that in some of his interviews, is that they might also have underestimated the breakthrough technology that they were putting there, up to the point that Sam Altman now is advocating for regulation. So that makes us think nobody was expecting this. I mean, I think the main factor there is, like, AI algorithms were sophisticated also 1 month before OpenAI launched ChatGPT. The thing, though, is that they created such an easy-to-use interface that people flocked to using it. And so whenever we look at the adoption of any new technology, the biggest obstacle is the friction in onboarding this new technology, right? Let's make an analogy with NFTs, for example, or like with crypto or stuff. Let's use NFTs as an example, right? NFTs, to be honest, also can have enormous applications. Let's say within pharma, NFTs can protect your health data because you can transform data into NFTs, and so you're the owner of your data and so on. There's a plethora of applications. What's the problem? Minting an NFT or just sharing an NFT through a wallet or even setting up a wallet via MetaMask, which are all of these necessary steps for you to own an NFT. It's not easy.
It's not easy, no.
It is not at all. And so that was the big problem with it. It limited the number of people who were willing to actually do and take all the steps. Now with ChatGPT, like, you can access AI algorithm free, first of all. So one big friction step is usually price. They granted it for free. Also usability, it's just a simple interface. And so getting back to the blue collar to white collar part is that although it came, as you said, from the white collar, I don't even think that white collar people were seeing that coming, not even the developers. And the interesting part that I also touch upon in my Meta Leadership book is that now white collars are under pressure and feel threatened because AI sometimes is better than them at doing cognitive work. Because if we think we're better leaders or C-levels or pharmacy owners just because we have more experience, we're smarter, we work harder, we have more knowledge, well, bad news is that AI is much better at than us at all of that, right? And so the problem is, what's our role now? Like, how we should look at skill sets and development, and what's ours, what's AI's? And so it's a very deep, almost philosophical question, but I think some of the business owners out there are going through all of this.
I read a pretty good example of why AI has taken off so well. And they said, like, for human flight, for years, they were trying to mimic a bird. I'm talking maybe the late 1800s or something like that.
Right.
How can we get better wings? Right. How can we get better feathers? How can we flap at a right rate? And how can we do all this stuff? And somebody came and said, you don't need to fly like a bird. You need to fly like an airplane. And it's fixed wing and all. It's something that people haven't seen before. So now you take AI, and all these years people were thinking AI might come up from the human neural network, this or that. And they say, well, here it is, computer learning, and it's not all that difficult. And guess what? Your brain fits inside of your head, but now this brain is as big as New York City. Now compete with it.
That's the point, Mike, as you said. I mean, people, they do not understand that the ability of processing data, which is the basis of any decision, smart decision especially, is incomparable now whenever we compare a human brain with that of a machine. And so, although it might seem a very radical question or maybe a very hard one to think about is, well, then, does it mean that humans should be the ones making rational decisions, or they should complement technology's rational decisions with their guts, with their feelings, with their emotions, and so on? So I'm not advocating, of course, for us living like robots and just performing tasks that were just said, okay, it's like this, take it as it is. By the contrary, I'm saying let's use our critical thinking. Let's use things that technology cannot do, which is basically going off the script, right? AI is doing nothing more than just replicating patterns that they've been trained with, right? Up to the point that Elon Musk already said that AI is just the reflection of the limbic system of the people who created it, right? So in a way, there's the human hand on it. Because if you train ChatGPT as it is over billions of parameters that though they come from the internet and the internet has been sort of like the content on the internet has been created by humans, it is sort of a reflection of the way that humans think. And that's why it actually works so well. But this means that, well, is the rational side of it all still going to be human prerogative? Or shall we outsource it to technology and focus on what's unsubstitutable so far? Again, our set of soft skills, our critical thinking, our ability to collaborate and feel empathy and so on, right? And so I think it's more of the latter, right, option, which is let's outsource to technology all of those tasks, even cognitive ones that used to require a lot of time. Like the other day, I was like having to draft a simple contract. It was like a very easy contract, but still I couldn't find any reference of it. I just asked ChatGPT to draft and it was like better than any lawyer and definitely much cheaper. Up to the point that I've said, okay, look at how much time and money I saved. Well, how can I better use that time and money to, let's say, maybe introduce new clauses within the contract or maybe close a different deal and so on. So it makes you more creative. It gives you back time, which I think is also our biggest resource as human beings. So it's a super interesting discussion, Mike. And I think, I don't know, like how often do you use ChatGPT, but wow, can be so helpful in our day to day. And I think for pharmacy owners as well.
I got some company trying to collect from me. I don't owe them the money, but they say I do. But they were hounding me and my attorney wasn't available. So I just wrote up a letter on ChatGPT, basically bug off for a few days. And if you need to contact someone, contact my attorney. So I copied it to a member of my team after I sent it. And he's like, that was really good. And I'm like, well, yeah, but I didn't write it. ChatGPT did. And he said, I know it was still pretty good, though, that you told ChatGPT what you wanted and where to go. And I'm like, well, thank you. So now the only accolades I get is if I push the right button on my keyboard or something like that. But I'll take what I can get.
At times, Mike, this makes a thing whether we're that smart or at least as smart as we thought we are or we were. But to be honest, I think that's part of the game. I think over history, many technologies substituted what humans thought they would do best. There's this great American legend that I don't know if you know about. Do you know the legend of John Henry? John Henry's story was that he was considered in the 1800s, like back in the golden age of railways construction, I think in the Midwest, he was considered the strongest man alive, right? And so John Henry, I think there's some movies, or at least one movie about John Henry. So anyways, he was considered the strongest man alive. And one day, man, like well-dressed, came to the construction site and he showed the master, the chief there, a new technology. A revolutionary technology. It was like a drill, a new drill, like a steam-powered drill, right? Drilling machine. And John Henry saw that and he said, well, you're praising this technology. You're saying it's better than humans and it's more efficient and so on. Well, so I'll challenge you and the technology to see tomorrow for 24 hours who is going to drill the farthest, right? Who is going to drill more? And then the dispute began. And to be honest, the drilling machine was faster. And so it was like by far winning the dispute, but almost reaching the end, well, the drilling machine broke down. And John Henry, one using his chisel, one of rock after the other manually, he won the dispute. But according to the legend, he, when he raised his hands claiming victory, he was so tired that he died, right? He died. He was so tired. And the truth is that this legend made me think the first time that I've heard about it is like, first of all, about this relationship that human beings have with technology that is like I'm better than you. But it made me think about something. What would have happened if John Henry would have survived the dispute? Well, I started thinking, after a couple of months, that salesman would have come back with a version of 2.0 of the drilling machine, much more efficient and so on. And John Henry would have refused again to be substituted and would have challenged the machine and so on. But it might have even won the second time. But what about the fourth, the fifth, the tenth time? There's no way John Henry could have won. And the truth is that this is our relationship with technology. We oftentimes try to fight it off and claim to be unsubstitutable. But the problem is that this is never going to work. And so it is much better to embrace it and to use it to our favor rather than being John Henry of this situation and just fighting it off, trying to claim we're unsubstitutable. And I don't know, it really reminded me about the situation we live now with AI and with ChatGPT and so on. There's some people who, like John Henry, try to say, well, this is dangerous, this is not for me, I'm not using it. But, well, there's also the other side of it. There's people who claim it is good for education. Well, everybody says it is very bad for education. Sal Khan, the founder of the Khan Academy, one of the biggest education experts in the world, says it is going to be good. Why? Because every student will have a private tutor and every professor will have an assistant, which is something that they cannot afford now. So there's a lot of reflections that can arise from this whole situation, Mike.
I heard someone say that AI is like the final product that humans had to build. Because start from the beginning of harnessing fire and all through the ages, those have all been helpful. But now it's like we've built something that can outbuild us now. So it's going to be fascinating. It really is.
It is. And again, what I think, at least for that's the implication for some business owners and pharmacy owners that are listening to us here. Again, try to embrace it as an opportunity. And some of the things that I think should change in our day-to-day jobs and people management and so on are, first of all, again, let's try to outsource to AI a lot of our decisions, but definitely thinking critically about the output that AI brings us. And this is a skill that I like to call data sense making, right? It's not about just being good at numbers. I'm not saying that. Let's just have AI perform and technology perform smart decisions that bring about interesting insights. I'll explain better. Let me make an example when I was managing Tinder, the dating app, right? So Tinder would generate a lot of data, right? There's the number of matches and swipes per day, the number of downloads and so on. And so as I started managing the app, I was looking at all of these numbers. But then I rapidly understood that they were not really helping me make better decisions. Let's say, if I know the number of downloads today, like it's up 10% respect to yesterday, usually we think it's good, but I don't know, maybe the market's growing faster. And so I started to understand that in businesses, we often look at data and use data to manage our businesses the same way as if we were driving a car. And instead of looking through the glass in front of us, we were looking through the rear mirror, right? We're comparing data from the past. And so I started to try to understand which KPIs could be more predictive of user satisfaction and how good the business was. And I started to understand, and Mike, you mentioned you hadn't had the opportunity to use Tinder. Now that you are speaking to me, you might have an excuse, at least for a day. You can say, look, I was talking with Andre. That's usually the excuse.
Check out his work.
Right. You can say for professional purposes, but that's just for a day.
Yes.
But anyways, so what happened is that I started understanding that there was a KPI, a metric that was very predictive of a user satisfaction, which was the rate of matches they would have for each swipe they would give. So let me explain Tinder 101 for who doesn't know too much about it. You have to swipe either right, means you like a person, or swipe left, you don't like that person. And if that person swipes right on you back, it's a match and you can start chatting with that person, right? So when I noticed that people with a high rate of matches per swipe, right? Let's say that you swipe right on 10 people and you get 5 matches. Well, half of people liked you back and you're like, I'm good looking. I feel great. I'm meeting a lot of people. I'm having a lot of conversation. So I, as a manager, was understanding that if cities or regions or demographics would have a high rate of that, they had a bigger chance of staying within the app and being satisfied. If you have a low rate of matches per swipe, let's say you swipe 20 times and you have one match, you feel bad about yourself. You feel like people do not like you, you don't talk to people. And so I started understanding that it's the manager's duty to set the right KPIs. And it's not too much of like making the calculations, but if I was looking at always the same report with the same KPIs, it's like I'm trying to use a fighter jet and to do very interesting, like to improve the way that I drive it. But if I look at the same numbers at the same cockpit as before, I have a very limited range of new things I can do. So if we change the cockpit and try to predict the way the engine can work and so on, well, maybe, and that's the same thing with businesses. And I think AI can be a tremendous ally with that. There's other things that AI can help business owners do, can help managing people, like outsourcing some of the more transactional day-to-day information sharing part of it, taking notes in meetings and stuff, so it saves a lot of time. But yeah, there's the plethora. I do use ChatGPT a lot. I do use also other AI tools. There's also an image generation tool that is Midjourney that is simply amazing, right? I've seen the image of like, let's say someone generated the image of like a campaign for a lipstick, and it was much better than any agency would do.
What's the name of that? Discord?
Yeah. It's all through Discord.
And there's really no reason. I guess they were using Discord to improve the product, and it just kept being through Discord. It's kind of clunky, though, to realize you have to go to Discord and then do it and so on.
Besides being on Discord, which already is not very intuitive, there's something else to it because you type in the request for the image, and there's like other thousands of people typing in the request. So your image gets always, because it's like a timeline, so it always gets put up. And so you have to scroll up a lot.
With the whole AI thing, it's like, all right, I can see some businesses that are maybe not too happy, just like the cliche, the buggy whip and things like that. But it's like, all right, if tomorrow the life expectancy of all Americans rose to 100 years, and if the infant mortality went down to this, and if there was no more lung cancer, AI found a way to get people to stop smoking, and if we could take afternoon trips, we could hop in the space thing and you and I could be talking face to face in the same coffee shop or something. It's like, all right, well, now it's done something. My point is that we sometimes get stuck in the mundane, but let the calculator of AI come in and do its stuff for us, and let's set some higher goals.
Yeah, you're perfectly right. And I think it gets back also to something that is deeper into human being, which is our sense of purpose as well. I think brings about this philosophical dilemma up to the point that, interestingly enough, I've heard Yuval Harari, the author of Sapiens and Homo Deus and a number of other books, saying that basically more and more philosophy will be important in the age of AI, because AI will bring about a lot of new ethical questions. Let's say, for example, you're an engineer and you have to design the software of a self-driving car. You have a big ethical dilemma, which is how do you program it to respond whenever your car is driving and there's two kids on the road playing soccer and there's no time for you to pull the brake, right? Do you save the driver who is alone and an adult, or unfortunately hit the kids? So that's just an example. But overall, AI is putting a lot of pressure on our sense of purpose, and at the same time that it can make us much more creative, can give us time back to go towards our more fulfilling endeavors. And I think you touched upon something really interesting, which is longevity. Also something very strong related to it, because if we think about the jobs that are projected to be growing more and more, especially because they're also unsubstitutable by technology so far, is caring of elderly people, nursing. Like, for example, doctor can be much more easily substitutable than a nurse, right? And so there's a lot to it. And when you mentioned about longevity as well, it reminded me of, I don't know whether you follow the story of Brian Johnson. Brian Johnson, he was the founder of Braintree, which was a company that acquired Venmo, the cash splitting app. And Brian Johnson, he's a multimillionaire. And he launched a project where he's slowing down his aging. And he's all over social media now.
Oh, I saw the guy. He says he's so young, but it looks kind of like he has purple hair almost, right? He's doing all this stuff.
That's the point I was making, Mike, which is, yeah, we can aim for longevity, but to be honest, like, is that really worth it all? Because to be honest, I don't think he takes in like 60 pills. That's his breakfast. He was eating like very weird stuff when I watch him on a video. And so, well, why don't we let the course of life and let's just not push it too much to the limit?
He doesn't look good. He looks like the guy, I don't follow the Marvel stuff that my kids do, but he looks like, I want to say it's like Loki or something. With his hair back, he just looks terrible. And he says he's like getting younger.
That's the point. And so, and I'm laughing with a sort of cringing in between, which is, why do people now feel like technology is okay? I understand outsourcing to technology a lot of it, but let's not force also something that I think goes too much beyond. I don't think this is really healthy or helpful. Peter Thiel, also one of the big VC investors in the Silicon Valley, is also investing a lot in longevity startups. But longevity aside, what I think is that there should be an equilibrium, as in all things, right? Technology also should definitely help us, but we cannot really push it to the limit, up to the point that, again, if we empower it too much, that could be really harmful and dangerous. A lot of people have signed this plea to stop the development, at least for the next 6 months, of AI, and Sam Altman is agreeing. He testified in the Senate, and he said he agrees with that. So there's this other side to it. Let's not misuse. Doesn't mean let's not use too much. But again, as business owners, we should identify what's in for us, starting from the pain points that we have. Also, if we do not feel the need, there's no need for us to push ourselves and just roll out new technologies. We might overcomplexify something that there's no need in there.
You can make it too complicated, and sometimes it's just not the time for that. Yeah, that letter from the AI group was going to maybe follow suit and tell all of my competitors to not fill prescriptions for 6 months until I get some stuff figured out. I don't think that letter's going to do a lot, because who's going to want to give that up? I mean, they might do a lot kind of like the arms race when countries might say, well, we're not making nukes when they probably are kind of thing. So maybe they're going to be doing it in private, but I don't see people stopping that.
That's the same with the environmental goals. To be honest, unfortunately, countries plea to environmental goals, but then you've got polluters like China and India not able to stop emissions. So what's the point of like a small European country, like let's say Switzerland, reducing their CO2 emissions? So it's a conundrum there, but it will be very similar with AI. So there's a number of factors in there.
Andre, we talked about AI giving us more information, maybe things we haven't thought of before. And I know one of the focuses of your book, one of the six main themes, is reperception.
Yeah.
And you think about that, and you think about all of us old fart pharmacists that are going down the same path, and we say, well, of course I'm doing it that way. My customers need it that way. And it's like, well, the ones you've tallied, but the ones you haven't tallied are no longer your customers, so you can't speak to them. Are we stuck in our ways, and are there ways that, oh, just AI and just looking at the world can maybe see different directions?
Wow, definitely, Mike. And the truth is that it gets back to that topic of exponentiality, right? If the rate of change of technologies, of customer behaviors, of market competitive forces and so on is changing faster and faster, that means that we as leaders and pharmacy owners, we should also question our beliefs, set of knowledge, past successes more and more often, right? To the point that I'm sure that many of our listeners have seen some of their past beliefs being broken down during the pandemics. For example, oh no, my customers really want to buy in physical stores and they would not purchase like low priced items online because it doesn't really make sense. Also, that people do not want to, let's say, subscription models in pharmacy will not work, right? And we've seen that they have started working. There's this RO, it was called Roman, but RO startup that is now a unicorn, and they just sell it D2C by subscription, gets to your home. So we've seen more and more of these beliefs. And the problem is that the more successes we've had in the past, the harder it is to give up on those beliefs. And so There's this great book by Adam Grant, the Wharton professor and a great keynote speaker. It's called Think Again. And he says that, oddly enough, the better we are at making decisions, the worse we are at rethinking those decisions. Because our ego and our combination of past successes and these beliefs, they actually work. But will they work in a world that's changing? And so my provocation here is to for our listeners to think always, are the set of beliefs, knowledge, experiences that I've had in the pharmacy sector still relevant in a world where the customer is changing their expectations every day? Because if we think about our customer, at the same time that they purchase products at the pharmacy, they also use Grubhub, delivery, Uber Eats, and so on for instant gratification. They have hyper-personalization through their favorite e-commerce. They have low-friction experiences through, let's say, super apps or immersive experiences in, like, retail stores. They start shaping their expectations about pharmacies based on those best experiences and not based on what we've always done or based on what another pharmacy does. And so I think that's the point. We always have to update our beliefs, our knowledge, our expectations based on what's happening out there and not based on what has already happened inside of our business. And that's extremely challenging. It ties a little bit in with the conversation we've had about data, but it ties in with this topic, as you mentioned in the book, I called reperception. Our ability not just to make good decisions and stick to them, but it's about rethinking our decisions and updating our vision of the world and of business and of the customer in face of new evidence.
We've had delivery service at our pharmacy for years, and many pharmacies do. But a few months ago, I'm looking at software online. I'm like, we can do this better. And then I come across this program. And I got to give myself some credit. I didn't make the damn thing, but I at least looked for it. But it mimics Amazon, basically. So it tells the people that we're going to be there during this time. It takes the picture of it and sends that to them. And we left it here kind of thing, the whole Amazon thing. But we as small business owners, we can get these weird ideas like, well, people don't want that. They just want to call on the phone and talk to us. And we'll say, sure, see you later, Mrs. Smith. We'll be around this afternoon. It's like, all right, you can keep thinking that while Amazon is taking over the world and all these different things. So it's like, you got to be open to that stuff.
Definitely. And you know what's the hardest part of it all? Is that oftentimes, Mike, whenever we ask our customer, they also reinforce that belief because they don't know what they need. There's this great story by Steve Jobs. 1 year before launching the iPhone in 2006, he was doing focus groups and he would ask people which kind of smartphone they would dream of, right? What was their dream smartphone? And everyone would ask for basically a bigger smartphone with a bigger screen and a bigger keyboard, a plastic keyboard. Nobody ever asked for a touchscreen phone because they were asking for just a bigger BlackBerry, right? And so the innovator's duty is not just to respond to what our customer asks for, but to anticipate what they need without them being even able to ask for that. I think before the pandemics, we would ask to any of our like parents or like grandparents, we would ask them, would you ever consider buying something online from a pharmacy? And they would tell you, no, I love going to the pharmacy. Then they started buying that online because they were forced to during the pandemics and they loved that. And now sometimes they go to the store, but sometimes they purchase online. And so it was also based on our customers experimenting these things and not only asking them what they think about some innovation, because sometimes they will tell they don't want to, but when they use it, they love it.
About 5 years ago, I hired in basically another management level at our pharmacy, and it's very hard to manage that correctly when it's your funds that are going to be funding the ideas, because out of, let's say, five things, it is true that the old business owner says, oh, we tried that before. We're not doing that. Three out of the five times, he's probably right. Two out of the times, he might not be right. The problem is you don't know which ones are which, and you can't really afford to do all five. And so it's a tough thing to manage.
Yes, and especially because some of these initiatives in the short run, they will not necessarily provide any clear return. By the contrary, it might, like, first of all, fail. Second, if it doesn't fail, it does not necessarily bring in revenues in the short run. So it's hard to balance. It was, I think, called by Professor Clayton Christensen from Harvard, the innovator's dilemma, which is, okay, I want to reinvent my business, and I know that maybe I should do this and that, but when it's time to execute, these stay ideas, and they do not translate into execution. Why? Because doing all of this can be inefficient. And there's also the ego part. Adam Grant, in his book, Think Again, always says that, like, ego is the worst enemy of leadership, because especially when we lead or we own businesses, there's, like, all of this ego bait from our colleagues, from our teams, and so on. And the most inflated the ego, the harder it is to rethink and to admit that sometimes we might be wrong. So there's a whole lot of things involved there, but definitely it's an interesting psychology of business management.
I think one of the dangers of change is you look at the leaders like Amazon and TikTok and Instagram and all these things that have floated to the top. And when we were younger, when I was younger, you'd say, the internet's such a great thing because anybody can do this and you can make your own this or that. The problem with that is, how many Amazons are there in market share, and how many Tinders are there?
Yeah.
There's some, but there's a crap load more failures that happen. You can look at the pile of apps that you've never heard of before for task management and dating and all that kind of stuff.
Definitely. No, it's really not easy. There's, like, another phenomenon, which is path dependence, which is phenomenon explains we make decisions about the future based on our past successes. There's, like, information bottleneck, which is we usually resort to a limited set of data available because it's easier to find whenever we make decisions, right? We always look at what we feel most comfortable with, and data sets, or, like, the range of information that we have available to make informed decisions, while we neglect all the other information. So there's groupthink, which is, like, we sit down and confront ideas with the like-minded people, which is nice, but at the same time, it has its own risks, which is does not bring that critical thinking. So it's a mix of features, but I think that also ties a little bit into diversity and inclusion. I definitely think it is also very important, beyond all things, also to prepare our businesses to think differently. And so I think confrontation of idea with people, from people with different backgrounds and with different upbringings, different education, is extremely important. And sometimes having people who resort into the examples that I gave before about the beginner's mindset, having people who do not necessarily have the same experience as us can be even beneficial rather than detrimental, compared with just surrounding ourselves with people who have a lot of the same experience and are very much like-minded with us. And so that's even why I think ChatGPT and AI can be a good tool, because they tend to think at least differently, and you can provoke them. And there is always the think as if you were prompt that works amazingly. You can make him or think as a marketer, as a finance person, and so on. So there are some tools to that definitely can help us along the way.
And I think the value, Andrea, of, let's say, they bring you in as a keynote speaker, or let's say as a consulting of some sort, is there's so many politics that go on in business that, and even a small business, the nepotism of someone's niece, the boss doesn't want to do that because their sister might get upset. All this stuff, there's so much of that drama from small to big that it's hard to be open to ideas in your company, because there's the CEO pride, but there's also a good idea sometimes comes with drama. Like, if I open myself up to Sally and I tell her that was a good idea, I might not want to use the idea, but then she's going to come bitching to me 3 months later how I never listen to her and I don't do what she says and all that stuff. So that's where I think some of that like you say, the ChatGPT is pretending you're somebody or bringing in consultants is good because that expectation's not there.
Yeah, you said it right. I mean, to be honest, whenever we ask for an opinion and we do not necessarily follow, that creates a bad, as you say, precedent. And so in a sense that people start not trusting that leader anymore too much. So
and the leader stop asking.
Exactly, because then it goes both ways. And so you just don't get the input. And so that's, well, I think Simon Sinek calls it the circle of trust, right? That circle of trust breaks down, which is this kind of like psychological safety space where you have reciprocation, the reciprocation mechanism built in, and where you have people collaborate based on the trust that you create among. It's exactly the opposite. So I think, yeah, well, that's really important, by the way, for us to establish as business owners and pharmacy owners, this kind of like trusting environment where people feel that they can put forward suggestions, bring about ideas, ask hard questions, and they're being heard. Because otherwise, we will scare off people, even by judging people based on their mistakes and not asking for them what they've learned from it, whether they learned to avoid repeating that mistake in the future. So if we create this environment, we'll have people who are much more engaged in the innovation process and the business reinvention process than if we were scare them off and just giving orders as leaders and just trust me and so on. Micromanagement is inversely related to the level of trust and engagement with people.
Andrea, you mentioned when we first started speaking about how speaking to a group over 100 doesn't go back to our evolutionary roots of tribes and things like that.
Yeah.
What other instincts do we humans have that a leader maybe has to push through that natural tendency to lead or be successful? Which human traits kind of pull us back down?
Well, I would say definitely there is the kind of like, you might call it the survival instinct mode, which is definitely something that makes us feel, okay, we live in a world of finite resources. And within a business, a finite resources is just our wage sometimes. It's a bonus, it's a promotion. And as human beings sometimes, although as a species overall, we're pretty collaborative, at least much more collaborative than just any other animal species. Let's say you put 100 people within a room and you put 100 monkeys in a room. Well, 100 monkeys will bring to chaos and fighting off over resources. And you put 100 people, well, if there's good leaders in there, you might come out with a new religion or with a business. So we are pretty collaborative. But whenever we live in an environment of scarce resources, and oftentimes companies are that, we should definitely try as leaders to fight off that individualism and that kind of like competitive behavior that it exists, that is very much related also. And at least it trickles down in behavior such as lack of collaboration, such as talking behind the back, such as trying to undermine others' career, which oftentimes happens. That leads to very big business problems, because when there's lack of collaboration, there will be a lack of innovation, I would say, eventually. And so lack of business results. If there's no collaboration, people will make repeated mistakes. There will be no communication across areas. There will be a lot of work repeated. People, decisions will be centralized. And so people will have to wait a lot for people, for their superiors to make their decisions. So there are a lot of problems. So I think one of the human instincts that fighting for survival has to be also fought off by very good leaders. And it's not easy to push for collaboration. One of the solutions might be to make these resources more available. Oftentimes, it's not possible. So what's the best way? It is definitely as leaders to create this feeling that if people collaborate, these resources will grow faster than if people do not collaborate. So I think that's very much of setting a vision of companies, like tying in collaboration with better business results. And with better business results, the bigger the pie.
Andrea, a pharmacist is listening to this, and they may be a store owner or middle management or something like that. What information would you share with somebody in that position?
Well, what I think is that it is much more about asking the right questions rather than just thinking that our job is to just be full of answers and just of knowledge. What I mean by that is that let's be open to change and understand that whoever dictates what's next within our pharmacy and our business is the end customer. And so if we do not pay attention through the tools available, data, observation of behaviors, putting ourselves out there, we will not be able to react to this. So I think whenever we look at this very short time span for communicating anything, it is definitely of looking at what the customer's doing and basically reacting based on that. So I think it's very much related to this. And that's my advice. Let's not be fixated upon our past successes, but definitely let's be open to this change, which is going to be faster and faster, but there's no other way than to adapt. That's the only way of thriving and growing. Otherwise, there's no space for our businesses anymore, because one day someone will come in and fill that gap, taking away from us that market share, taking away from us that customer. And so I think as a message, I think that's a message that I would like to leave to the pharmacists and business owners and middle managers. It's definitely that one. Reinvent yourself, or unfortunately, you will be a spectator and an observer of the changes that will happen within your business.
Tell us the name of your book again, Andrea.
Yep. So my book is available on Amazon and libraries in the US. It is called Meta Leadership, the New Leader's Skill Set in the World of AI and Web3.
Good stuff. Andrea, nice talking to you. Sometimes I don't like getting an author or a speaker on because they sort of, it's like getting Rodney Dangerfield on The Tonight Show. They just come out. They're not conversing. They're just doing their show, but they're sitting down instead of standing up.
No.
And you were quite the opposite of that. That was a fascinating conversation. And thank you very much. And I encourage pharmacists to get a hold of your book and contemplate these things for the good of their businesses.
Thank you so much. I definitely know what you're talking about. People come in and it's a good way for them to feed their ego. That's definitely not the case. I just had a great conversation, Mike, and I really appreciate the time that you gave me here on the podcast.
Thanks, Andrea. I look forward to keeping in touch.
Same here. Thank you, Mike.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.